Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Buffalo Bills Maybe Next Year, a podcast that doesn't write good either. My name is Frank.
I'm Scott.
I'm Paul. Did we get our screw-up out of the way by laughing already, or do we have to still screw up the intro?
Yeah, we did. Okay. No, I think, you certainly covered it now, if we haven't done it already. We are here to talk about Bills football, and as it was just dawning upon us before the show, it's pretty much weekly Bills time. If not now, then very, very soon. The Buffalo Bills have a football game next week, August 13th, and they are in the midst of training camp now, which is where we will start our show.
Football game in quotes, though, to be clear, just in case.
Yes. Right. Football game in quotes, and we'll explain that later. Kind of like one of those tricky BuzzFeed headlines. You'll never believe what the Bills are doing next week, right? TLDR. It's a preseason football game. So training camp day four, we're here. We're not here. I was in Rochester before camp started, so I think that counts as me having gone. And so I will say that it looked good from the window of my car as I passed the St. John Fisher exit on 490 on the way to Canandaigua to bet on horses at the racetrack. You can look that up. That's a thing. But the training camp, we've got intrigue and questions and thoughts and all sorts of happenings as we go into this season. Let me start with Scott. Scott, what are you watching in training camp, or what are you looking for? What are you worried about? What do you want to see development on? Give us your open up to us about training camp.
So, I mean, obviously there's a lot of things that we can talk about with training camp. I mean, obviously the list of people who are not in training camp yet or are not in shape enough to be in training camp is lengthy, and hopefully, you know, a lot of that's precautionary with your Carlos Williams, your Marshall Darrisses, your Shaq Lawsons, your Sammy Watkins, and that's one big thing. And obviously injuries is always kind of an easy concern. Obviously, none of these games count. None of these training camps really count. So, obviously, getting through that without any injuries, that's kind of a big deal too. Beyond that, I think the biggest thing, the weird thing for me now in training camp is, a couple years ago, I felt like the depth wasn't an issue because the team was terrible. If that makes sense, like if the drop from the starter to the backup was kind of irrelevant because they're both of them were terrible players. Whereas now, you look at, like, the drop between Shaq Lawson and Ike Nkumpale, like, and it's a much more significant drop. Or you go down, you know, Manny Lawson's, you know, also not practicing, and I didn't even really know exactly who the backup is, the other edge rusher would be in that kind of scenario. So I think I'm definitely outside linebacker, that kind of edge rusher position is something I'm concerned about. Because we are so thin there, I think that's definitely one that I'm concerned about. And the one that, I mean, I'm not saying that Nkumpale can't do it, but I'm not sure that I saw much that would indicate that he could last year, which is not off to a good start. I mean, there's some other guys on the roster here trying to look like names that, like, there was a guy, what was his name?
A guy. I remember him.
A guy. Yeah, so that, yeah, well, anyway, we'll come back to Mr. Guy later, but anyway, so that's what I'm worried about.
Go ahead, Paul, sorry, Frank. No, that's fine. I was just going to quickly mention
Randall Johnson,
yeah, he is third on the depth chart under the ER edge rusher, which I guess is the new DE. We don't call them defensive ends anymore, they're edge rushers. Okay, I was going to point out that it's pretty impressive that IK is basically a huge drop-off from Shaq Lawson, who has yet to do anything in a Bills uniform.
Other than
hurt himself.
Paul, in the light of the media.
Right, yeah. Paul, please, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no, this is a good stuff. So, I mean, there are a lot of things to watch. Scott mentioned some good ones. Some things I want to keep an eye on, you know, the defensive line specifically. We've talked, everyone has talked to some degree who's Bills fans about, oh, Mario is addition by subtraction, but is he really? Is whoever replaces Mario better than subpar Mario Williams from last year? And as we've talked about Shaq Lawson, he's not going to be around for 4 to 16 weeks, depending on who you believe, next season. That's going to be problematic. The Bills' defensive line was subpar with Mario Williams last year. They have not added anyone of note who's going to be playing the full season this year. So, you know, how does that improve? And then I think the counter-argument to that could be, well, they've had an extra year in this defensive system. How well do these players, a lot of whom are carryovers, gel from last year? That's going to be something that's very interesting for me to watch during camp. I think one thing I always like to watch during camp is what veterans are going to age out that you don't even realize are at the end of the line. I always think back to Greg Williams' first season as Bills coach in 2001 and the uproar when on the final cuts they got rid of kicker Steve Christie and safety Henry Jones, two long-term Bills, done a lot with the team. Christie had kicked the all-time long field goal in team history and had been consistent over the years. Henry Jones was a Pro Bowl safety, number one pick for them, first round pick, I should say. And, you know, there's a lot of criticism, but what we inevitably found out is, you know, I believe Jones played a couple more seasons, as did Christie, but they were nowhere near form with the teams that they joined. Granted, the replacements, you know, Rayon Hill and Jake Arians didn't do anything in the league either, but we found out that, oh, those are two veterans I didn't realize at the end of the line. So I always like to see, you know, which veterans are at the end of the line that maybe we don't even realize are at the end of the line. We found that out a bit last year with Fred Jackson, who's still unpicked up by any team. What makes this interesting, what if those veterans who age out are guys like Kyle Williams and Manny Lawson? That's a huge problem because those are two players who are being depended on by this team to be high performers in 2016. There's obviously the number three receiver. We're going to discuss that later when we get to listener questions. And then the other thing that you always should pay attention for during camp, the injuries. We've talked about those that are in process, a number of guys that Scott pointed out who are not even going to start in camp. You know, how are those injuries going to heal themselves? We heard Sammy Watkins will be back on Monday the 8th. Will that be the case? We'll find out. You know, and then we have to keep a close eye on, you know, those injuries that happen. There was Kevin Cobb, seemingly a little minor nick to the head in a preseason game. His NFL career ended with that little nick to the head. So you have to keep an eye on what's going on there because that can affect the team's plans. In the case of Cobb a couple years ago, that meant thrusting E.J. Manuel into a role which he was not ready for, and we know how that story seems to be progressing. So many stories, you know, so many things Scott and I haven't mentioned, and Frank, I'm sure, will mention a couple other things. But really always, this is what makes football interesting is, you know, you only get 60 minutes a game times 16 a year to really truly analyze, but this is what lays the groundwork for those 16 games.
So under 1,000 minutes, if you don't go overtime, that'd be 960 minutes of football, I believe, if I've done that math correctly.
Yep, you've done the math correctly, 960
Wonderful.
Minutes of football.
So, there you go. Yes, I think along some of those lines, I look at, I won't be looking at it because I don't know how to evaluate it, but I will wonder how a guy like Jordan Mills will do at right tackle with Cyrus Quanjo backing him up. I think that's one of those places where I'm kind of sick of seeing Cyrus Quanjo's name anywhere. And so the hope would be that he could, you know, fend him off. But I mean, Mills is a bit of a journeyman lineman as well. So there, looking at the line as a whole, I think that's one of those places where you gotta focus on, or not focus on, but worry about injuries, because while Glenn Incognito Wood, you know, is a good left side of the, Leonard, you know, center left of the line, and then you've got Miller Mills who might be okay, you know, then if you're suddenly going back to Shanshel Henderson and looks like a guy named Ryan Groy, G-R-O-Y, like also a left guard.
From?
Like, I'm guessing Wisconsin.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Well, is he any good? Because I've never heard of him.
No. I mean, honestly, well, you know, it's one of these things. I mean, I think
he was good at Wisconsin.
He is actually one of the more mobile guards that we have had. There's, okay. I'm sure if you go on YouTube, you can find him blocking 30, 40 yards downfield, like basically not quite running step for step with Melvin Gordon, but pretty close. Like he could get out and move, and he was pretty athletic. He had good feet. I don't know that he ever. I mean, part of the thing is, I mean, guard's obviously not the easiest position to play. It's certainly not the toughest either.
Right.
But I think he might not have had the bulk for kind of an NFL guard, but I think in our kind of offense, I think we're a little more into the pulling guard mindset, and I think that might suit him well.
Okay. Well, let me shift my, ire. No, it's fine. Let me shift my derision to Keith Lumpkin. If you could pick a name, I'm sure he's a wonderful person, but if you could pick a name for a guy who shouldn't, like, who should be, like, the, like, schlub of all schlubs, it's Keith Lumpkin. And so, like, let's hope that we don't get down there at some point where it's like, well, they're relying on Keith Lumpkin, who was in camp.
Lumpkin coming in off the bench here.
Uh-oh. Glenn's not moving. Let's turn to Lumpkin.
Say, Glenn looks like a Lumpkin, and here comes Lumpkin.
Right. Another play, okay, in more optimistic news, or more optimistic camp viewing, I think, one thing I would like to know is how well Cardale Jones plays. I think that I had sort of forgotten until I looked at this depth chart that we had even drafted him. And I think that's kind of fun because even though he's not going to be the backup this year, and I'm sure he will be practice squad and you know, or one of the guys that doesn't dress very often, his development will spell whether they need a new backup quarterback next year or whether they, you know, he could inform on the starting role depending on how things play with Taylor and how well Jones plays, I guess. I don't want to, let's hope that's not the case, but I mean, I think that's he's an interesting project to me. And the other place is running back, where you have this weird log jam of running backs, including the new guy, which I will try and segue into. But you have McCoy at the top, and then you have Carlos Williams, who's going to be gone for 4 games, or so, and he's probably going to be basically too fat to play for a while.
Fat Carlos, we've agreed to call him.
Right, Fat Carlos. And then you have like this thing where it's like, okay, do you keep, you know, do you want to keep Mike Gillisley? Do you want to keep Jonathan Williams, like who we put a little energy into getting? James Wilder Jr. probably, you know, is a body for camp. And then does Reggie Bush take one of those spots now that he's been signed as the punt returner? The dynamic Percy Harvin playmaker past his prime on an incentive-laden but cheap kind of contract role. So, you know, starring as Percy Harvin this year is Reggie Bush, who, you know, might be able to do some good things on the punt return, might be able to do some good things in a two running back passing attack. But there's a lot of running backs already on this team, and at least one of them is very good, and one of them looked kind of okay last year. You don't exactly want to throw Carlos Williams away yet. What do you guys think about, I guess, the running backs or the signing of Bush? Paul?
Yeah, this is a very good question. I was contemplating this one earlier. When you look at, first of all, I an interesting debate on Carlos. I almost want to call him Fat High Carlos. And Bush did not show up fat or high. So I think he's got that edge.
He's the edge there. Right. I forgot that he also was like way high.
Right, and he's not suspended for 4 games, which brings up that we could always have another discussion on, well, was he high or was it performance-enhancing drugs because he showed up fat and was trying to get in shape? Right. But that's an interesting debate for another time. I think back to a scene in the movie Moneyball, which is a baseball movie for those who've seen it, based on a baseball book, where the general manager tells David Justice, who is once a phenomenal player, who is at the end of his career, like, I'm not paying you to be the player you used to be, I'm paying you for the player you are now. The Bills do not need Reggie Bush to be 2013, 2012, 2011 Reggie Bush. They need him to be a better player than was 2014, 2015 injury-laden Reggie Bush. You know, they don't need to be the Jerome Bettis situation where it's like, oh, his career is dead. Ah, we'll give him another shot. Oh, wait, now he's had a Hall of Fame career. The team just needs a guy who's going to step in, help on the punt return, 6 carries a game for, you know, maybe he can do four yards a carry or so, which he hasn't done since 2013 season, and just be a guy who can give a rest to LeSean now and then. You know, give you 8 yards on a punt return on average. I don't know if they're going to use him the kick return game or how relevant the kick return game is now that they've changed the touchback rules. That could be another good discussion as we start to see the preseason unfold. So I think he fits in very well. The bottom line is, you know, he's got to come in and realize he doesn't have to excel. He just has to come in and be better than Mike Gillisley, be better than Jonathan Williams, and Boom Heron, I think they re-signed as well. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this shakes out. It could go. You have LeSean, who the word is he showed up in the best shape he's been in years. Now, of course, they can say that in the preseason, but I always remember in 2007 before that season, like, hey, this guy in the practice squad, Freddie Jackson, showed up just in phenomenal shape, and it was the talk of camp. And we thought, who cares? And then in 2007, we found out why we should care. And then Freddie, of course, had an extremely productive career with the Bills. As a result, yeah, it's fascinating. I'm glad to have Bush in the fold. I'm glad that he gets a shot. I would not be surprised if he's the team's number two back. No more or less than I would be surprised if he is not on the team in a few weeks because it's been determined he's past his prime. But add the bodies. It's nothing to lose. Sue's going to rise to the top and hopefully hold the place until Carlos gets back. And hopefully 2015 Carlos is the real Carlos. So apparently I had more on that topic to discuss than I thought I did. So that's all I have. And I'll just end on this thought. Fat Carlos.
Understood. I think for me, the Reggie Bush thing is... I don't like it just because, honestly, I would have rather kept trying out that kicker, to be perfectly honest. And I know it was him and Kane Coulter who were signed on the same day. But frankly, like, I see many more games that we lose this season because of a missed kick than a second or third string running back doesn't do his job. And certainly that Reggie Bush is the difference between that second or third string running back. I'm not saying this kicker is going to be the answer, but this is kind of a good time during camp to bring in these guys and test them out. I know on the first day he was beating Carpenter. He had made all of his field goals and Carpenter missed two. And obviously that's the smallest sample size possible, arguably. But at the same time, I feel like that I'm thinking might have been a little bit better use of a roster spot in this early training camp days than going out and get a guy whose primary role is going to be on special teams for the most part, from what I understand. We already have a guy that we kind of brought onto the roster. I think Javier Arenas is a guy who they were looking at as to be the kind of punt returner, one of the DBs. And then I feel like, you know, so that's my concern, is that there is another roster spot, in fact, that we could have used that more helpfully on than Reggie Bush. And, you know, I think the running back position in general, I mean, obviously it's not ideal that Williams is out of shape and that, you know, the other Williams is a rookie. But I think we can make do for the first couple weeks here without having to lean too heavily on a guy we're bringing off the street, you know, after training camp starts.
So. Yeah, I want to jump in on Scott here and say, so your argument, if I break it down, is the Bills more desperately need a backup kicker, and Javier Arenas is a solution to all the Bills' kick return problems. Boom! I dropped the mic, but I'm wearing a headset, so I can't actually drop it.
I don't think we need
and hear Scott's reply.
I don't think we need a backup kicker. I think we need a kicker. And I'm not convinced that Dan Carpenter is the guy, so I'd rather have a competition and find out if this Morgan kid was going to be the guy. I don't know why they even brought him in unless they were concerned about the kicking spot. So I'm not saying we need a backup kicker. And in fact, I still don't know what Jordan Gay is doing.
that none of us know. Maybe Jordan Gay knows.
Jordan Gay's got those photos of Rex Ryan and Rob Ryan in the compromising position.
He just sits really quietly in the room and hopes nobody notices.
It's like, wait a second.
Anyone else we forgot to cut? No, I don't think so.
That's what it was, is that they were running through the kickers. And they're like, well, you definitely don't need three kickers. And they're just like, oh, it was the rookie. Yes, let's get rid of him. And Jordan Gage.
Well, I do think.
Sorry, man.
I sort of agree with Scott on this one a little.
Damn.
Well,
winner.
The good end. Well, Paul's right, like in how Bush could fit,
flip-flop.
Right? But like, yes, I know. Just vote for me, okay? The point is that in camp, I don't know that part of me is skeptical about whether this team really can afford the luxury of a punt return specialist guy. Second of all, we are sort of a little rich in some areas and maybe not at other places like kicker. It's funny because The kicker to me is more important.
I don't mean to count, I don't mean to jump. Well, I do mean to jump in because I just did it. But are we with the kicker based on one season where Carpenter struggled with the new extra point rule but was still good on field goals after a phenomenal year the year before? I'm just playing devil's advocate on that one.
Sure. And I would. I guess I would just say I'd like to. I like the competition because maybe we have a guy who can get more extra points. Or maybe we have a guy who can kick just as well but is cheaper. Or maybe, if nothing else, you save somebody's leg so in December they aren't somebody was splitting kicks in August with him. Or, more importantly, I think that where you kick the football ends up, and I don't know this for sure, but my instinct is telling me that where you kick the football ends up being more important than who is catching and returning the football. Because a lot of punts are fair catches. There's like opportunities that are gone by that if you don't trust your field goal kicker get turned into punts or long fourth downs that you have to kind of hem and haw over. And if we already are resigned to the fact that, coaches aren't going to be aggressive on fourth down anyway, well, then I would at least like to have, the best kicker possible to score points.
I was going to give credence to your guys' argument, which is if Marshall, Marshall Morgan may be available down the road, and if Carpenter struggles in the preseason, you can bring him back, hopefully, and then, maybe Jordan Gay does re-enter the fray. Now I'm actually going to move my mic up so I can't interrupt anyone anymore.
Well, then you just, the only problem then is you don't really know whether he's any good or not because you cut him in the first week of camp. And so you would just have to hope that, well, what we saw was pretty good. Anyway, it will ultimately probably not boil down to, this guy or Reggie Bush as to whether this team.
I hope it doesn't.
I hope, especially now that I've said it, yes. But my guess is that, this move here isn't going to be the make or break move. It likely is some rearranging of the deck chairs on the Titanic that will be the 8-8 Buffalo Bills. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I was going to say, spoiler alert, man. Lifting
lazily to the side, the Buffalo Bills.
Training camp, Reggie Bush, and let's get our last little bit of football news before we move on to the errata the rest of the podcast. But the Tyrod Taylor contract, I guess the negotiations have been in constant talking. Sorry. There have been constant negotiations, that's what I'm trying to say, between the Taylor camp and the Bills front office regarding his contracts. And the most recent rumor is that the idea is he would be picked up. He's already under contract for this year, but he would get like a pay bump for this year, and that the remainder of his contract would be contingent on him hitting certain performance goals throughout the football year. So this way, the Bills, provide themselves some sort of assurance with regards to he does a bunch of things. Excuse me, he does a bunch of things that we want him to see him do, and we don't have. Before we offer him the contract, and it helps Taylor because if Taylor is a good football player, he gets his long contract sort of kicked in. And if the Bills don't see it, then they can walk away. It's sort of like a super version of the guy from wide receiver Percy Harvin contract from last year,
where the escalator or a incentive or whatever.
Right, it's a little right. It's sort of an incentive, but instead of like. You get an extra $100,000 for every touchdown you make. It's like if you throw 25 touchdowns, you get a 5-year contract for $90 million.
Right. And I think what we'd all like to see is it tied into team goals, specifically the playoffs, because that's going to motivate him not to compile personal statistics, but do what he can to win games for the team.
So what do you, that's actually where I was going to go is why don't we brainstorm or throw out ideas and try and determine what we think and this comes from Scott, who came up with this idea, not so much me, but I'm in charge, so it's my idea. And what types of incentives we think that the team should be looking for, be they team or personal or a combination thereof. And so you said team goals. Paul, why don't you give us some team goals that you think ought to be included?
Right. I would think, here's where You know, again, I think the ultimate team goal is going to be wins. So I think you want to tie the biggest contract triggers for him into wins, which is, you know, 14 wins, your contract is now going to be 4 years, 90, you know. It obviously, you can't change the entire term of the contract. You can note that that gives you $5 million more than 12 wins would, which gives you $10 million more than 11 wins would. However you want to frame it and have it be a team playoff issue. You can also add, I'd be light with other incentives simply because you're going to be like passing yards, then you're going to see Taylor in at the end of 42-5 blowout games, whether he's on the winning end or the losing end of that, when you just want him to get out of there and take off his house. So I wouldn't want to tie too much individual stats, except mainly, I'm trying to think, like, maybe points, victories in the final 2 minutes, you know, comeback wins, those, and again, that's tied into wins, maybe even points scored in the final 2 minutes of games that are within 10 or something. So even if he's not leading you to the comeback win, it's reflecting garbage time. It's not reflecting garbage time passing. So I think you've got to be a little creative, but I think there is a way to structure this that says, like, in Buffalo Rumblings, which we've encouraged people to read, frames this perfectly, which is, like, the conundrum here is, you know, the you contrast his existing contract and his lack of sample size versus, you know, what he did it, where he outperformed his first, you know, the deal by far last year. So this is kind of a way to balance that out. Just like, look, we're a team. We don't have the sample size. We don't know how you're going to be. But you were the biggest bargain in the NFL last year. So let's find something that's the marriage of those two concepts. So that's kind of my brainstorming on the matter.
Scott, anything to add or contrast with Paul's?
Yeah, I mean, well, so this is a tough thing. Is obviously, like, it would be very easy for us to sit here and come up with a list, but we can't negotiate with Tyrod's agent, who I'm certainly would say, you know, like hell, you're going to have wins be any of these things, because this team was 8-8 last year, and Tyrod is just one guy, so. To hell with him being held accountable for the wins. In fact, I'm not even sure that I would say the Bills would want to be held accountable for the wins, because frankly, let's say, you know, again, like, the defense goes in the hole, you know, LeSean gets hurt and Tyrod plays the whole season, but, you know, the Bills still go 8-8, but he still, you know, plays at a Pro Bowl level. I'm thinking that we still want to sign him, and if we give him a low ball offer and make him sign something, or we pitch him something that is the deals, you know, take her to leave it, that he's going to leave it. So that's one so the wins thing is one thing. Negotiating if it's not someone else, you know, not another person in the room here we're negotiating with. I would be in favor. I think team goals is something. I would do something if the wins is one thing. I kind of, obviously, you know, obviously that's the thing I care most about. I also think it's probably the one least realistic to get in there. I'd say you'd have better chance with something like offensive ranks or offensive yards, something like that, where you'd have Tyrod's a little more control in that he's moving the offense. You know, you can't control the defense. You can't play defense. So that's just out of the equation. So as long as he is moving the ball down the field, so I don't know exactly what the yards per game, but if the offense was moving the ball 300 yards a game, you know, 12 out of 16 games or something, like, that would be one where I'd think, like, that might be a good one to kind of hang your hat on. And then I feel like, unfortunately, it does have to get down into individual statistic numbers. I think that's just one of those things where you're expected to do it. I think that's the most realistic thing that an agent would agree on. So, you know, honestly, I feel like we'd all be comfortable with last year's numbers. I mean, wouldn't you guys be, if he put together, you know, 3,000 total yards, not necessarily 3,000 passing yards, 3,000 total yards, you know, above 65% completions, you know, roughly 3-1 turnover to interception ratio, touchdown interception ratio, I feel like that's in the ballpark, right? Isn't
it? I think that so perfectly points out the difficulty of arranging this type of contract, because you perfectly deconstructed why you can't base it precisely on wins. But if we do what you propose there, then that's when we could end up encouraging him to be on the field during garbage time, getting 100 yards when it doesn't matter, and throwing two touchdowns in scenarios that just help him get to these incentives.
Yeah.
So I guess that's just my way of saying, yeah, that makes sense. You know, there's definitely logic there. There's definitely fallbacks with doing that, and I'm glad I'm not an NFL agent or an NFL GM trying to figure this out.
There's also
I have three or four more, too, actually. A couple other requirements. Must be snazzy dresser at all times. He was bringing the A game last year a lot, but
yep.
I'm going to need to keep seeing him put on some fine suits, some nice shoes. Want him always looking on point.
He can't take a Tony Romo step back on fashion.
Oh, yeah, no, exactly. We haven't even gotten to Tony Romo.
From Tony Romo courting Carrie Underwood to, you know, fat married Tony Romo.
I want Tyrod escorting at least two ladies across, old ladies across the street every week for the entire regular season. I feel like that's the minimum. That's, you know, being a part of the community is important. So I want to see two old ladies thanking Tyrod on Twitter after he escorts them across the league. I'm also going to need to see him, again, be a part of the local community. I want him to open a used tire retail kind of resale place. It has to be known as Tyrod Taylor's Touchdown Tire Factory or store or something.
Or Emporium, I think.
Emporium, exactly. Yeah. Something like that.
It should be a part car garage, part Taylor. He should be the Tyrod Taylor. Bring your car in to get service. We'll patch up your suit at Tyrod Taylor.
We'll fit you for a vest. You know, we'll come through the whole thing. The other one is he must come on this podcast at least four or five times during the year. That's the other thing that has to be in the contract, I think.
So I feel bad that – well, I don't feel bad. But I have to now go back to – because I actually had serious thoughts about the contract that I didn't share. So I feel bad because I don't want to step over your really well-thought-out jokes. Those were good. Let's all take a minute to appreciate that.
Yeah, everyone absorb those jokes right now.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll ease back into it because my – and I am not doing the plates tonight, whoever that was, by the way. I know one doing group. Okay.
That was a down to Scott or a Phantom.
Okay, I will say I have been hearing a rhythmic clanking noise on someone's mic for a while now, and I haven't said anything. That was my wife throwing the baby monitor at me, so that is what that is.
Very nice. I'm closing the door so the dryer no longer echoes into the room. Okay. I couldn't tell if someone could hear
it. Kudos to me for my – I win the award for least ambient sound.
Maybe next background noise. I will ease back into the contract by saying I think that the actual standard should be how many times Tyrod Taylor is named the first star on this podcast over the course of the year.
That's a good one. I like that. Yeah.
He should have a minimum number of stars or something. Well, that's like, you know.
Yeah, average. He has to average at least one star over the course of a year.
Yeah, like 1 point. He has to be average like a 1.4 or something. He can have some twos and threes.
It's like Pro Bowl validating. You know, that's people's contracts.
Okay, but with the contract, I think that you guys outlined a lot of the stuff I was thinking, and I think the contrapositive idea was missing was that he could play terribly. And the team could get a lot of wins. Like there's that weird world where like he could, you know, Tebow it and like accidentally, you know, make the playoffs. And you wouldn't want to be tied down to him after a season like that necessarily. But what I was thinking was you could take all of those ideas and have a series of checkboxes and you'd say, okay, here are 35 criteria that we think are promising and good and like we would want to see. You don't have to get them all, but if you get 20 of them, you get this contract, and after, you know, every two or three more after that, you're, as Paul was saying, you can have a graduated level of things. And that might be like some of them might be very simple, like start 14 games, start 15 games, start 16 games, something like that, or be healthy for 14, 15, and 16 games. You know, passing totals, touchdown totals, but then you cap it at a certain amount so that way you can't just run up numbers across the board. You're going to have to dip into some of the other things like, I don't know, maybe make it like Sammy Watkins is a 1,500-yard receiver or I don't know if we quite want to do that, but like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it doesn't – more team-oriented goals, winning, making the playoffs, winning a playoff game. Like, those are all things that you could, as part of the contract set up, and so that way doesn't have to go one way or the other, but if you get a plurality of these very good things happening, you can then say, okay, we'll agree to the contract.
I think that's probably a good idea. I mean, I think that, again, you get into the agent arguments here about Tyrod doesn't know what he's supposed to do, But I still think that's probably the most reasonable thing of having a lot of criteria, and he doesn't have to meet them all, but has to meet some of them. I think that makes sense.
Okay. Well, let's move on from that and stuff that we don't know about to stuff that we don't know, have to know about, which is namely listener questions and our wacky schedule stuff. Do you guys want to do schedule stuff, or do you want to do listener questions first?
Well, we do. I would say listener questions, and then I do have a This Day in Bill's History that should be brief. But, yeah, I'd say we do, you know, and then we do the wacky schedule.
And we can rush through the wacky schedule if the questions are good.
Right, or what I just thought it was a wacky schedule, because what listeners love is when we set our agenda while we're podcasting.
Yeah.
I think, what if we're running short on time by our own standards, we could just do one wacky game a week, or two wacky games a week for the next 4 weeks, and then kind of stretch it out a little bit so everyone's like, oh, you know, they've got something to look forward to other than us talking about football, because people don't like us talking.
I was going to let Scott make that decision, because he's the keeper of the wacky schedule.
Yeah, as much as I love wacky schedule, I would actually say people don't really like the wacky schedule, so let's just get it over with and get it out of the way in the next 2 weeks, and then we can talk about real football.
I think we concur. Listeners, you vote. Okay. We'll do the four today, and if you disagree and say stretch it out, then hell, we'll do one and a half a week or something.
Yeah,
we
anyone get cares. Yeah, if I can just come up. I can just email you with more random scenarios for games if you're that interested.
We're gonna go to listener questions and comments. We're gonna thank Luna Reinhardt, who just said go Bills and is apparently a listener. So thanks for listening. Or maybe she's not. Maybe she's just commenting on our page. But hopefully she's listening, because we just thanked her. Brian Punt, feel free to ignore this if it's too incendiary. Oh, you know what? We'll come back to that, because
we discussed that one off air one time, a similar topic. Right.
Well, let's not. Brian's question is basically, would we rather prefer Donald Trump to be running the Bills or the country? And I think I'm just going to say that we're not going to answer that question. But since we brought up the fact that we actually haven't discussed that off air amongst ourselves, because, of course, he was up for buying the Bills, and I think we're just going to leave it there, because two of the three of us have jobs in the United States government. And not that we feel like I certainly feel like I could talk about it. I just don't want to. I'm kind of sick of it.
And I have a boss who would not appreciate me discussing that topic based on his views. So
there's talk of this in the wacky schedule. Who's to say?
Oh, right. Well, maybe we'll come at it in a roundabout way, let's say. But we're not going to have a conversation about it. But we thank Brian for his thoughtful question and encourage you all to just, you know, hey, let's turn the maybe next year into a flaming political mess pile like every other Facebook page. Go for it, guys. Then we had our quick update that we'll be pushing our taping back to Tuesday. Steven says, it looks like Robert Woods will be the number two receiver, and I've heard some say he's not that good, and he gets it just because there's nobody better. Do you think he's a legit number two? If not, how big an impact will this be on the Bills' passing game? Paul generally deals with Steven questions first. Go for it.
All right.
And as the former wide receiver, as the only professional wide receiver.
Yes, by professional meaning high school. So with that in mind, and that's a good question. I thought that too, because let's go back and look at a history of Bill's number two wide receivers and compare him to those receivers. Now, unfair comparison, James Lofton. Hall of Famer, not going to happen all the time, difficult to do. Eric Mould's had Peerless Price. Definitely superior to Woods in terms of production. Then you're getting into the Lee Evans era when Lee Evans was the number two. Lee Evans was a superior number two to a lot of people. But then you start looking at more recent Bills history. Remember, Lee Evans number two for a while when he was the number one was Josh Reed. Similar to Woods, he was a good blocking receiver. Woods is a much better pass-catching receiver. Look, more recently, Stevie Johnson in a pile of I won't say it, because I like David Nelson, I like Donald Jones, they were all good guys, but let's face it, they're out of the NFL for a reason. So I would say he will be, but I'm going to agree in some way with Steven. Like, he's impressed me with his blocking. He's had some good games. You know, I remember that 100-yard performance, I think was it against the the Jets, where he just seemed unstoppable in the passing game. But I think there are a lot of better number two options out there. And the good thing is, I don't think it's going to have a huge impact on the Bills' passing game because of the non-wide receiver factors. And I am assuming a healthy Charles Clay and a healthy and productive LeSean McCoy taking some of the weight off the number two receiver. So that's my hope.
I think that's a good point, Paul. I think hopefully the way that Greg Roman is designing the offense is always a run-first offense anyway, with Tyrod's skill set, with LeSean, with the money we put in the offensive line. Even with Sammy, I think we're still kind of built around running the ball. So I think if you're looking at the number of passes who are going to Robert Woods, that's going to be cut down already. And then, you know, just because of the passing game, and then once you go through your passing targets, you know, one is Watkins, but then two or three are arguably McCoy and Clay, and then Woods is really kind of your number four receiver in some ways. In terms of someone though who can split out wide and can catch the ball, can make you pay if you're not on him, or if he finds a hole in the zone. Yeah, I mean, it would be great to have, you know, Julio Jones and frickin' Roddy White from a couple years ago. But, you know, you're not going to get that on a lot of teams unless you built your offense that way. So I think for what we want to do, I think he's fine. I think last year he was dinged for a lot of the year. He kept going out there. It obviously affected his performance. I still am a believer in Robert Woods. I think he can be I think, just putting all kind of rationality about the Super Bowl part of this aside, but if he is the number two receiver on your Super Bowl on your team, I think you can still get to the Super Bowl. I don't think that there's like, if the rest of the team is good, I feel like he's not going to be like the missing link, kind of.
Steven also wanted to hear about the state of the running backs, but I think we covered that when we talked about training camp.
Yeah.
I feel like we've talked a lot about that. Paul, did you have questions from Twitter?
I had a lot of questions from Twitter. We will go in reverse order here from David Furster, who threw a bunch of questions at us. I did promise, because of the delay, we would answer them with 100% accuracy. So, David, you can thank us later when these all prove correct. Should Carlos Williams have to sit in a stool wearing a dunce cap and DARE t-shirt, that's capital D-A-R-E, the drug program, anti-drug school program, while reading a diet book the first day of camp? I'm going to say, yes, he absolutely should. I fear there's probably collective bargaining agreement rules and agreements with the NFLPA that are going to prevent this. Do you guys agree with me? Have your own takes?
I say no.
No, you're not? Okay.
No, I'm going to say no. I think that DARE was a wishy-washy program, and I think that, I'm going to say I'm in favor of Carlos Williams doing drugs, not anybody else doing drugs.
Okay.
It's all a right. Bold view.
I'm going to say, yeah, I'm fine with it, but I think you're right. There probably would be some eligibility contract adjustments there, I think. So that may not work. And that may not work well.
All right. Good answers. And one of them is right. We just don't know which one. Who replaces Chris Hogan as the number three receiver? Again, we've all, to some degree, touched on this already. We just finished going into the number two receiver issue. Let's face it, as Steven mentioned, by de facto or not, Robert Woods is kind of established as the number two receiver. Behind him, you've got names like Marquise Goodwin. You have names like Dez Lewis. You have Hankerton. Is that his name? I can't even think of his name.
Hankerson. Leonard Hankerson.
Yes. So there's a bunch of options. I was going to pick the underdog pick, but honestly, they're all really underdogs. I don't think there's anyone you could say is a favorite in this, but I'm going to say it's going to be Greg Salas, actually. I think, you know, he is not a star receiver. He's been with six clubs in 5 years, hasn't caught a lot of passes. I think in his previous roles, they've tried to sandwich him into more of an outside receiver role. I think Greg Roman would be smart enough to use him for his strengths, which is in the slot. Where he has very good escapability. He definitely can create some good separation because he's a physical guy, not unlike Robert Woods. I think he's been pigeonholed into roles where he just didn't really fit because he doesn't have the speed. He doesn't have the burst. And I think on the limited sample size we saw last year, you know, I liked what I saw, and I think he's going to fit into that role. Don't know about you, gentlemen.
Does anyone think Marquise Goodwin has a shot?
Oh, I think he's got a shot. I think everyone's got a shot.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's such a poor field. It's such an even field.
I think Goodwin has a chance. I mean, I think he is the kind of the guy that they want there. I mean, if you want someone in that Chris Hogan type, like he is, I mean, he doesn't have the hands that Hogan does. But in terms of someone who's kind of smaller and can find cracks in the zone to a little bit, I think he could do that. Obviously, I guess they've already kind of worked him in a little bit more in terms of some of the underneath routes. He's been basically a go route kind of guy for his entire career. And I like Marquise. I think he's done some good work for us and Olympics aside. But I would also say that there's a good chance that it could be Des Lewis. I think that that's someone who is who I think coaches always have a bit of a bias for guys that they drafted rather than guys that they brought in through free agency. And so I think this guy has had some good flashes in mini camps and then also since then. And I think that might help him get over the line and get into that third or fourth spot, stay on the roster.
I will say Pikachu.
Not Charizard?
No, well, Pikachu...
Pikachu, to be fair, Pikachu only has 46 fewer career receptions than Greg Salas.
That's fair. Charizard is actually probably better because I think that one flies. So I think that's probably a better option for a wide receiver than Pikachu.
But his cap number's a little high, though. That's the problem.
It is.
For a third guy.
I want to say Snorlax, because Snorlax is the best one, but he's also huge and fat and probably more of a lineman.
Again, big cap number. That's
he's a big Pokemon. So there you go.
Pikachu would be great with your Pokemon Go routes.
Yeah. there it is. Aww. Good night, everybody. In all honesty, I'm going to cheat and say it's actually Charles Clay. And I know that's not the question you're asking, but this is going to be such a limited. I would imagine that over the course of the year, the third wide receiver will get 32 to 50 targets. Like maybe two balls will be thrown to him a game.
That's probably the theory of the offense at this point.
Right. That's they want to run the ball and they want to. So I don't. It could be Charizard for anybody's going to care. You know, all you have to do is be convincing. All you have to do is be good enough that they have to cover you. Like, yeah, that's it. Somebody actually has to actively care that you're on the field.
Yeah.
And so that's what I think of that. Go ahead.
No, that's a solid point. The only and we won't address this question now, but it always like I think it's not going to matter as long as Chris Hogan doesn't become Wes Welker. So history will show that. Here's an interesting one. Is Nick Foles an option to replace EJ? You know what's funny is when we postponed our podcast, I thought, well, it's too bad this question's going to be out of date by the time it, we podcast. Here we are. Foles is still out there, but honestly, I think that answers the question. I think NFL personnel talent have determined that, you know, his limited success was not due to anything he was doing particularly positively, that he has some skills, but he's not really a viable NFL option. So, you know, I don't think Foles is going to be around. I really don't see him as a guy who's going to even be I don't even know if he's going to be a backup in this league anymore. I guess time will tell. I'll go over to Frank. I keep giving Scott.
Yeah, no, I think I even saw, I mean, I'm with you exactly. I think I even saw in Buffalo Rumblings that somebody from the Bills said that they were not interested in. So there you go.
Yeah, Nick Foles doesn't really do anything for me, and I'm sure he would want more money than EJ does. So.
Yeah, there's probably a veteran minimum we'd have to pay him that I'm not interested in paying him.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm not even sure. Well, I guess it depends on if he literally has no other offers, but I'm not sure he would take the minimum, but maybe he would.
Right.
All right. Are you worried about Kyle Williams still being a solid player? Instead of answering first greedily like I've done on the first four, Scott, what do you think? You still worried about Kyle?
No, I think the biggest thing is the injuries. I mean, I think obviously that increases with age, and that, you know, that will be the thing that obviously catches up to all of us at some point. But I think I'm less worried about his physicality and his performance level. I'm much more concerned about just his injuries catching up with him. So that's not really much of an answer, but so I guess I am a little worried, but as long as he's getting on the field, I'm happy that he's out there, I guess.
I'm more worried only because he's coming off one of those injuries and he is a little bit older, and at some point that you do turn back into a pumpkin, I suppose. But I don't know. I don't have any real reason other than fear to think that about this year. So I'm going to I'm going to say, I guess, you know, slightly more worried, but not really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Brian, you could title an article on this topic, From a Meatball to a Pumpkin.
Yes.
So my views are almost exactly aligned with Scott's on this. I think if he's on the field, he's going to be solid. You know, he's had the history of injuries, but I've seen, you know, guys like Pat Williams, Ted Washington, Kevin Williams with the Vikings, all guys who were later in the career and were still very effective. But my worry is Scott's worry was, are these injuries just going to start to pile up where he's only on the field 8 games a year? Last Twitter question, and thank you for David for all of these. Now I'll start with Frank on this one. What do we do at safety if Aaron Williams' neck injury ends his career? Now, I'll give the caveat, and I'll give Frank some time to think on this one. Aaron has been out on the field. There haven't been any signs that his career is over. He says he feels good as of yesterday, but, of course, sometimes you never know. And maybe he doesn't think it's going to end his career. But like Damian Covington, who thought he could come back from drop leg, makes it to camp, and then he's like a shell of the player he is, and he never plays in the NFL again. So what do you think the Bills would do if, indeed, Aaron isn't able to, you know, step up?
The short answer is we lose a lot of football games. I mean,
there aren't a lot of options behind him.
No, you're talking about you throw Duke Williams in there again, and you lose a lot of football games is probably what happens this year. And then you need a safety next year. It's way too late in the game right now to find a guy even remotely comparable to Williams that would be available. Maybe you could get Ed Reed to come back, and he could jog around the field a little, but that's not really going to help. I don't know. I mean, could you turn a guy like Darby or Gilmore into a safety? Would that even be worth it? Because then you're sabotaging your cornerbacks. I think the short answer is that, you know, what do? You play it's very unsatisfying, but the answer is you play the next man up, and you probably have a huge drop-off like we did last year in the defense.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of scary. I mean, I think we did. I mean, that's again, gets back to my earlier point about the differences between a couple years ago and now. Like, Aaron Williams is a good safety. Like, he really kind of found a home there, and we do kind of drop off very quickly after him. I think there was someone that they were looking at who they thought might have the ability to kind of step in and add some value there. And I think it was maybe it was Blanton. Maybe that's who it was, who they thought was a little bit more than a journeyman and might be able to actually get some decent reps in. I mean, I think Duke Williams is, we know exactly what Duke Williams is, and that's an eighth linebacker a fourth linebacker or a fifth linebacker. And he's not someone who you can trust in coverage. So hopefully the Blanton guy, he is someone who we can maybe rely on a little bit more. You know, he played for Minnesota in 2014. He got, you know, he had some good numbers there, but he didn't play a lot in 2015, even though he was active for a lot of those games. So it's not ideal, obviously, but again, you can say that about a lot of the positions on the team at this point.
Yep. All right. That's it for Twitter questions. Thank you, David. And I will chime in with, I just agree with you guys. It's next man up. That next man's unfortunately Duke Williams. Safety isn't the most important position on the field, but it's important enough. I think the Bills would be relatively screwed if that happened.
I think it was important, and we'll move on, but I think it was important specifically for his, you know, I think you could see the difference in those 2 weeks we sort of talked about. You know, when he played, the defense sort of knew what the hell they were doing a little, and when they didn't, they were all over the place, and it's a real problem, at least from that standpoint. You do need somebody who can kind of make sure everybody's in the right place, if nothing else. So we have wacky schedule, and then we have the other schedule game that we can play too. Do you guys have yours, and we'll do that too, and then we'll do wacky schedule, and then we'll get out of here.
I love your idea, Frank, and that's why I don't want to rush it in at the end here. That is my thought, but I am happy to do whatever you guys think.
I agree.
Okay, you feel like we've done enough. We also have this day in Bills history, don't we? And we've probably been doing this for 35 to 40 minutes now. Okay, so let's do this day in Bills history.
We'll do 50. I think we're well over 50 minutes at this point. That's
okay.
Who's counting?
Yes.
Someone is. We'll do this day in Bills history, and then we will do the wacky schedule, and then we'll do a preview of the preseason.
So This day in Bills history, normally we do something related to the Buffalo Bills, such as August 2nd, 2 years ago, being the day Andre Reed was inducted into the Hall of Fame, kind of a significant event. But I thought, you know, I narrow the focus too much with this day in Bills history to the Buffalo Bills. So we'll do this day in Bills history as this day in Wild Bills history. So on this day, August 2nd, 1876, we're going to go back 140 years. Brace yourselves, gentlemen. Wild Bill Hickok, one of the greatest gunfighters of the American West, murdered in Deadwood, South Dakota. So we all know Wild Bill, notorious gunfighter, just shot three guys who were trying to kill him very coolly. You know, he was glorified in Harper's. You know, just so much reputation. Then he accidentally killed his deputy in an 1871 shootout. And, you know, that put him on some people's radars. He lived off his famous reputation. You know, he appeared in Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show. So there's your tie to the Buffalo Bills and their namesake. You know, and he worked as a guide for wealthy hunters occasionally as well. So this was, you know, large. He was arrested for vagrancy. He had just a crazy life. So in the spring of 1876, he arrived in Deadwood, was playing a lot of poker, and then at 4:15 in the afternoon, a young gunslinger walked into the saloon, approached him from behind, shot him in the back of the head. Hickok died immediately. He was only 39 years old. The legend says he was holding a pair of black aces and black eights when he died, and a combination that has since been known as Dead Man's Hand. So thank you, History Channel, for allowing me to plagiarize that almost in its entirety, minus some editorializing on my part. So, the trivia tidbit, the yes. young gunslinger who shot Wild Bill Hickok. Who Ooh. Was this young gunslinger? I will start, as always, with Scott.
I don't remember that it was always. I feel like there was a time when we started with Frank.
I don't mind going first.
But
I can go to Frank first.
I'm perfectly capable of doing it. I'm just thinking I don't want to deceive people who might think that at some point it was reversed. But regardless. Anyway, the answer is Carlos José Núñez. He was even though he did kill Wild Bill Hickok in the 1840s, was it? Something 1876. 1870. Sorry, yeah. It technically he was born in 46, so he's time traveling for one, which is kind of a badass move. But little did you know that he would then go on reform his life and become a bishop in the Catholic Church. And yeah, he was appointed in 1995. He was appointed coadjutor archbishop of Tucumán. And then in 1998, he was just a regular old archbishop in 1999. And then in 2014, he actually was elected to a 5-year term as member of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. So that's, I mean, again, like a lot of guys, you can find, you know, resumes, you can find, you know, what they've done, but not a lot of guys have been on the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. I mean, I think that says a lot about how many steps he's taken since he murdered Wild Bill Hickok in cold blood.
I thought for sure Scott was finally going to offer an answer like Keith McKellar, tight end from 1988.
Oh, that would have been good. I should have done that. That would have been funny.
And that spoiled my setup.
Damn coward.
I'm glad one of you guys went there.
I'll say Wyatt Earp because I've heard of him and I think he was in the Old West.
Sure. It was actually John McCargo. Who knew?
Oh,
man.
McCargo!
That was the first round bust. Murdered Wild Bill Hickok. Oh, I'm sorry. It was Jack McCall. Jack McCall. I'm sorry. Not John McCargo. My bad on this.
It's an easy mistake.
McCall said he tried to shoot others in the crowd, but all the remaining cartridges in his pistol were duds. He was tried, convicted, and hanged. So that is this day in Bill's history, Wild Bill's history, August 2nd, 1876.
Wonderful.
Yeah. On to the wacky schedule?
On to the wacky schedule.
All right. We're gonna not fly through these, but we're going to do them briskly. So the game, we are 8 games in. We are almost approaching the bye, but before the bye, the Bills go to Seattle. However, this game happens immediately following the United States presidential election on the first Tuesday in November, or whatever the date is, someday in November. As a result of said election, and we'll just leave it to the imagination. So what we will say is, the candidate that you don't want to win, they win. Now imagine there is then, therefore, a huge economic recession because of that candidate winning. Like the stock market crashes the next day, you know, everyone's, you know, running from the country because, again, that jerk from the other party, they won the election. So now, you know, there's hyperinflation, money's basically meaningless, but again, the NFL, you know, torpedoes, you know, damn the torpedoes full speed ahead. They're playing this game at Seattle. So there's almost no real monetary incentive on the line. You know, people are probably worried about their families, but there's probably a certain amount of pride about wanting to keep things going even though there's this huge recession.
Mm-hmm.
So go. Frank.
Okay. So it's
still a tough Seahawks team.
Yeah, I don't want to rely on that yet. I don't want to go to the – it's just going to be a football game.
No, it's just, you know.
I think that the Seattle Stadium is in a state of great disrepair already. I think that, amazingly, the recession is so – it's like a tsunami of economic turmoil.
Yeah.
As, you know, President Dr. Jill Stein of the Green Party has removed, you know – all semblance of, you know, public funding for anything and is otherwise, you know, denying vaccines do good. I feel like she's a safe target. Sorry. I don't think a lot of Green Party people are going to write in and yell at me. And so, you know, instantly somehow, like, you know, there's a plague that sort of goes through lots of Seattle, and because it's rainy up there and people catch colds and nobody has to get flu shots anymore. And I think as tough as the Seahawks are, they're also very sick. They're not feeling well, and they don't have the hardy constitution that Buffalo Bills players have, because as we know, the moment you play for a football team, you instantly adopt the qualities of the team you play for, which is why you can draft a quarterback from anywhere, I don't know, Stanford, and assume he'll play very well in the cold in Buffalo. And so the problem is, like, you know, people in Buffalo, we're, you know, hard hat going to work folk. And, you know, they've known about a recession for quite a while now, to be quite honest. So it doesn't even faze them.
Those liberal coffee sippers in Seattle, they got nothing.
They're done now. And so, you know, they just show up and they're like, it looks like the Ralph. Okay, let's play football. And, you know, and meanwhile, the fans and the Seahawks are, like, all discombobulated.
Dismayed. It's not a home field advantage for the Seahawks.
No, like, they don't even know what country they're in anymore. And, you know, meanwhile, the
Canadian troops massing on the border.
Right, yeah, it's complete chaos. It's just absolutely, you know, ridiculous. And for some reason, you know, fans are slamming each other through tables. And, you know, nobody really knows what's happening. And the Bills win 35-12. I think they really run away with that football game because the Seahawks are just completely out of sorts.
Yeah, it's sound logic, Paul.
Yeah, I've got a much simpler, shorter explanation. But yeah, this is the one set of circumstances when the Bills leave, where the Bills win, because obviously what's going to happen here, and not to bring Stanford into the discussion again, Richard Sherman is clearly going to leave the NFL to become an economist and solve this whole thing. So it's going to be the Bills because they're just going to be able to exploit that weakness at corner. So I think it's going to be closer. I think it's going to be more of a defensive battle. But I'll say Bills 17-14.
Interesting. I you know, I think I was thinking the Seahawks in this game, but I think Frank's logic is just so irrefutable. I mean, I think clearly just – I was literally just dying laughing as Frank was going through
the problem is, like, all of the world becomes Buffalo when the economic recession hits. Which is a terrible thing to say, I realize. I hope at least somebody in Buffalo is laughing as I make this joke. And Buffalo's in a resurgence. Like, the downtown is very good. So I feel like we can joke about it a bit.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Scott.
No, I'll say you convinced me and the Bills win. But I think it is a tighter one. I think there's still talent differentials, still a lot to go out there. But I think they get it done. All right, we go to the bye week. Then we go – this is a tough part of the schedule, needless to say. We'll talk about that next week. But
has the economy recovered
at the Bengals
bye week?
Next.
Has the economy
– Yeah, the economy – Yeah.
No longer a factor in the game. Okay, good.
Stock market stabilized. That is not a factor. However, again, the NFL, always up for ratings, and the Bills-Seahawks kind of catastrophe bowl in Seattle did not go that well. Mm. So they're going a little different tint here, and instead of the Bills and the Bengals, it's going to be 11 Buffaloes versus 11 Tigers.
Mm. Oh, man.
Paul's
this,
start
is, this, is just, this is just a battle royale, by the way. This is not even a...
not even a football game.
I really wish this were the Bills-Chargers, because no matter how many times you charge, you always got to pay the bill. But not being the case, and I stole that joke from Perfect Strangers, which was a show like 30 years ago, but it was hilarious.
Wow.
11 Buffaloes versus 11 Tigers. You know, I think the Buffaloes, they always hang in the Buffalo stance. That will definitely work to their advantage.
Yeah.
At the same time, Tigers are vicious brutes. Tigers have murdered all of our parents. Let's be honest here. We're all orphans because of tigers. So with that note, I just got to pick the Bengals.
It's a three-year anniversary just the other day. Yeah,
That should have been this day in our parents being ripped apart by tigers' history.
It was really messed up how they were all together that day, too.
Yeah. All
what are the odds?
Yeah, anyway.
I just got to go with the Bengals. Vicious, vicious creatures, those tigers.
I think that... in the free Harambe Bowl, we have to say that, tigers just are a little more versatile than buffalo. If a buffalo gets a hold of a tiger, it's going to take care of the tiger. The problem is the tiger has got way too much versatility. It can go to the side. It can jump. It can, it can roll on its back and, like, claw up. I think you've got to take the hunter cats. They hunt things. They are, animals. They're hunters. They go for the prey. And I think while they are big buffalo, they are unfortunately largely going to be prey for our friends, the tigers. So I'm going to go with Cincinnati, in this one.
Okay. I think you guys are meowing up the wrong tree on this.
Oh, okay.
I think if this was one tiger and one buffalo, I think you'd have a shot. I think the Tigers got
teetering. Okay.
I think what I'm looking at here is 11 Buffaloes versus 11 Tigers, and I'm going to tell you guys, I was in the Tigers locker room before this game. It was a little dangerous, but they're not team players. They are lone hunters. They're not lions. Again, 11 Buffaloes versus 11 Lions, I think you got to go with the Lions. Tigers, solitary predators, don't work well with each other. Don't know what plays are being called on the field. Again, it's this battle royale, but nonetheless, they don't know how to communicate. I think the Buffaloes have a natural instinctual stick-to-itiveness of them sticking together. I think collectively they can trample some of these Tigers, get ahead, and I think that's how they kind of run out the clock. I think at some point the Tigers kind of, a couple of them dead, there's going to be some Buffalo casualties, no doubt about that. No one's walking out of this game without some blood on them, but I think the Buffalo, I think Buffalo and the Buffaloes pull it out over the Bengals.
Okay.
Right.
I haven't convinced
that,
you, but
that
I
logic
like it.
There.
Yeah.
It's good. I am a zoologist in my part-time job. Moving on to another zoological creation, the Jaguars. In this case, what has happened is that Jacksonville, they're 0-10 at this point. The NFL just shuts them down. They don't even show up.
Oh, man.
They need someone to play in the game. At this point, college football regular season winding down, NFL picks up Florida State, undefeated Florida State, shows up in Buffalo. But this is the twist because, again, you always go back to, well, these are grown professionals. These are grown men. They can't – they're not going to run – they're going to be running all over these college kids. There's no doubt about that. Here's the thing, though. Because it's Florida State, all the Bills Florida State players, they don't play. They don't play. They don't. They can't go against the alma mater. They got loans due. They can't risk that. So the Bills have to go out there without Emmanuel. Okay, not a biggest loss, but nonetheless. Michael Leary, again, not a huge loss. Garrison Sanborn, long snapper. Ackerman, trying to long snapper on one week of the NFL. That's not going to end well. James Wilder, again, he may not even be on the team. Regardless, and then of course, so that is your matchup is the upcoming Florida Cardinals 2016 polls versus the minus Donald Harvey and versus DJ Newell. What it matters.
I think Scott, I don't know, Frank, if you heard it this way, but I think Scott was replaced by Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, you got a little computer voicey at the end. That sounded better, but we got the picture that it was that it was Florida. None of the Florida State guys will play against
you guys like Florida Garrison State. Sanborn and EJ Manuel.
I think you could even I think to make it even more fun, I'm gonna give EJ Manuel back to Florida State.
Back to the Seminoles, yeah.
He can go and play for the Seminoles. And I still think, you know, the difference between college and the pros is the college and the pros, and I think the pros are always going to win. It doesn't matter. So I'm going to take Buffalo in this one, especially if you give them EJ Manuel. I think they're going to win.
Okay. I'm going to go with the same logic as Frank. I want to be witty and clever on this, but I have had so many arguments with my, you know, friends who are Californians about USC and their peak and how they could beat certain NFL teams that I can't be inconsistent with that argument without those friends grilling me. So I'm also going to pick the Bills with the same logic.
Okay, all right. I feel like I think it'd be a game. Again, the Bills' defense is going to be a little thin, you know, with Ron Darby in there. I mean, I think we got some depth at corner. It's not like the cupboard's dry there, but I think that definitely hurts us. Obviously, you know, I see how it could go bad. Obviously, if Tyrod gets hurt sometime and then we got to go to Cardale Jones, then we're definitely talking about a potential Florida State victory. But I think I'm okay. I'm confident in the Bills pulling this one out, even with the Florida State player sitting out. So we will now move on to our final game for this quartet. And this is our old favorite, the time travel game. Bills at Raiders show up at the stadium. They're about to kick off. Suddenly, time spatial distortion. The Bills and Raiders fall back into time and end up in early 19th century Japan.
Ooh.
So this is around the time of the opening of Japan. So kind of in that late... So this is like 1840s when, you know, the Meijis are kind of on their way out and before Commodore Perry shows up. So it's a fairly modern society, but they certainly have no concept of football. They've certainly not seen a lot of these people before. So they're very confused. So anyway, so that's the situation the Bills find themselves in is let's call it 1840 Japan.
1840 Japan. I want to make sure that I have kind of a good timeline of history here. Yeah, so the Meijis are on their way out. I'm trying to stall as I Google more.
This
is late Edo. The Meijis are on their way.
Yeah, this is the end of this is the end of the Tokugawa shogun. Really, what we're talking about.
Guys with swords running around.
Sino-Japanese War, not even a blip on the radar right now.
Yep.
Maybe some ninjas? Who's to say?
Oh, no, yeah, shinobi, definitely.
Have the samurai been abolished yet as a class?
No, they have not. But there are plenty of ronin going around. This is about when you would have Lone Wolf and Cub, you know, scouring the sides of Japan, in their blood feud against the Yagyu. First of all, I'm stunned. I love this era of Japan. I'm sort of overwhelmed with happy feelings that you chose this because I really do love the end of feudal Japan as a period of history.
Okay.
I don't think it's a particularly nice one or anything. Like, they were really terrible to a lot of people. It's not like it's a fair, but the idea of the shogunate and the samurai, I mean, that's a very romantic period for me. And I think that I have
got a game to call.
Yeah, I know. Like, this is really bugging me. Like, I have no idea. So I'm trying to think through it. And they probably are very skeptical, of course. The fans and the people are very skeptical, of course, of these people who've shown up and they want to play this incredible game that they've never seen or heard, heard about. And
they,
I believe
they appear to be warriors at the beginning because they're much taller and larger and
they have these, you know, suits of armor on, sort of.
Exactly.
I think the problem is is that it is so easy to cause offense to feudal lords. In this culture, it is very easy to cause offense. You have, of course, would have, you know, the shogun would want to see this.
Would he have the seat of honor at the guard line?
He would, and he would sit there, and he would kneel, and then his people would kneel. And I think at first we would have a problem because no one would know to bow to him, and then to each other before the match. And then at any point that, like, you know, there's other things, like the hollyhock crest would be hanging all over the stadium, and like that's like the same as the shogun. So if you do something disrespectful in that area, if you pee on the side of the field, or you throw the football in the direction of the shogun, or the hollyhock crest, that's like throwing the football at the shogun. So I'm gonna say this game ends in a tie because everyone is killed. I think that
the samurai just hurt.
I think within 3 minutes, once they realize that like this armor is not going to protect them from swords, these people, like that, the real problem we have is everyone dies.
Everyone dies.
When Frank was predicting, I actually had to mute my mic because I was laughing that he picked my argument. I was going to talk about feudalism, specifically feudalism, and like how, you know, the rise
of it is going to
eventually. You're under the, you know, subs. You could be attacked by raiders at any moment, and so this game was going to go to the raiders.
Right.
Was going to be my thing, but we both went to the feudalistic aspects of the society, which is crazy. I mean, I don't see how I can argue with Frank. Actually, I can. I agree and disagree. Everyone dies, but I think the NFL rules say that then that goes to the home team, so I think it's going to go to the Raiders.
Okay, maybe they'll kick a field goal before he dies.
Right.
That would be the best thing. Would be like, you know, like, you know, you're going to die, and in a true masterful show of Bushido, the Raiders kicker and snapper and holder, like, persevere through charging samurai, and they show no fear, but they commit themselves to the oneness, the mu, the emptiness of the situation. And as he puts his foot through the football, the blade of a samurai goes through his midsection, and he dies, but he watches as the football goes up through the uprights, and a single tear comes down his one cheek, and he just says, "Perfection," and then dies
as his vision fades to black.
Right, and then he's the only one that gets a funeral out of all of them, because they samurai then like realize like he was a true samurai, and they bow to him and kneel to him, and they realize, you know, the Raiders kicker, whose name I guess I should look up now.
Janikowski self.
Yeah, Sebastian Janikowski. Well, we went back in time. I guess they could have picked him up along the way. Sure. Sebastian Janikowski.
I think he actually was an early 19th century draft pick. He's been around for a while.
Well, he was the one true samurai.
He is the Polish
of the game. And so, and I don't mind losing in this manner, other than the fact that there's nobody left for next week.
That is tough. Well, we'll have to work on the time space continuum in the off week. I don't know how I can follow that. I was gonna make some.
See, you should send these out before, so then we can like arrange them by
by magnum opus level.
Right.
Talk. Yeah. No, that's fine. We'll work on that for next week. But I was gonna have some stupid thing about penalties, like this. That's it. Okay. We're done.
I'm sorry. I
won't even make a pick. That's not.
You caught me off by. I was just so off guard. I just kept talking until like something
good.
Sounded good.
That
That's
was gorgeous. That was gorgeous. We're never gonna get another one like that. no, I think. Yeah. So just for the record, I'm gonna take the Raiders in this one. Just
okay.
Because,
so the I'm the only Raiders, one picking a tie. Okay. Good.
The Raiders averaged 8.7 penalties last year, whereas the Bills averaged 8.9 penalties last year, and so I think that's gonna be a big impact in the game. The end, and that's right. your wacky schedule. Next week we'll end up with our last four games: home Steelers, home Browns, right. Home Dolphins, and at Jets.
So Frank has it at 7-4 in death is the Bills' record. What's your official pick on that one, Scott? I guess it would also be all death, right? So
no, it's the Raiders. I'll take the Raiders.
I wonder how death will affect. I mean, like the whole team dying. How that will affect the playoffs? Will they be in the hunt still?
Yeah. It's going to complicate that graphic, and it'll just be like, you still have the Bills on there, but just asterisk, like, all dead. Like, and just, and then, again, there's like a way that the Bills can make it in somehow, where it's like, if everyone else loses at that point, then, like, the Bills also would lose all their games, but there's some tiebreakers, maybe the Bills could still win, and they'd get into the playoffs, but then again, you just, you know, you break the streak, so I guess there's that.
Right, yeah, that's true.
And they finally win in the Western time zone, just the very, very far. Oh, well, I guess now, I guess that's the Far Eastern time zone. So yeah, it was that point.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Wow. I'm just going to kick it back to Frank. I'm not even hosting. Frank is. So I'm just going to back out of this and kick it over to Frank.
Frank, take over.
If you have become one with the...
One with the football.
I am. I definitely. I'm like looking at my shelf where Shogun is, and I'm like, I haven't read that in years. I'm gonna reread Shogun because. And if you haven't, you know what? That's our Bills pick of the week. If you don't want to read
your homework assignment.
Yeah. If you don't want to read a book about the Bills, go pick up Shogun by James Clavell. If you can find the 2-volume hardcover that I have, which I found at a used bookstore, get that one because it's gorgeous and it's a wonderful story and. Feudal Japan is awesome, and we'll, you know, maybe next Dotonaku, if I could say
the Asian name. Epic, yeah.
Yes, right. Anyway, BBillsMNY on Twitter, BBillsMNY@gmail.com, Facebook.com/BBillsMNY. You can search Buffalo Bills. Maybe next year our podcast will show up. BBillsMNY.wordpress.com is where we post our podcast, and you could go there to click on links. That's all the places you can find us. I mean, it's the social media world, guys. We're the Buffalo Bills, maybe next year podcast. Next week, the Bills play the Colts in the preseason opener. It's happening. We're going to have to put many of our childish things aside on this podcast and actually start talking a little more football.
Potentially
which
Potentially our children.
Yeah, we have 2 children amongst the 3 of us now, and so, yes, they will have to also be put to the side. I think that's the end of me talking to my daughter. But it was nice while it lasted. No, that's not true. I love my daughter, and she will watch football with us. But anyway, we will be getting more into the spirit of football, really, because it'll be preseason for us, too. And until then, feel free to hit us up with some questions or comments or what you'd like to hear, what you'd like to stop hearing from the podcast. We'll probably ignore a lot of that anyway because we have very much enjoyed doing our own thing. But thank you very much for listening tonight and always. We do appreciate it. We will see you soon. Until next time, my name is Frank.
I'm Scott.
Hi, I'm Paul.
Good night, everyone.